invocation of executive privilege or testimonial immunity, or both, by the former president. Judge Amit Mehta raised questions about the existence of any documented evidence substantiating Navarro's claim that Donald Trump directed the invocation of the privileges. "I still don't have any inkling of what the president's words were," he said. Stanley Woodward, Peter Navarro's defense attorney, said that he too wished there were more physical documentation of the executive privilege, but he argued that the unconventional approach did not invalidate Navarro's right to defend himself by saying he thought he had been formally restricted from speaking to Congress. When asked about his communication with Donald Trump, Peter Navarro said he did not email him directly and communicated with him through his aides, adding, "He's not a text guy." But the Justice Department said there was nothing to prove that Trump even saw the January 6th subpoena, much less evidence that supports the claim that he formally shielded Navarro from testimony. The defense contends that it would have been inconceivable that Donald Trump would grant executive privilege to all his other senior advisors who had been subpoenaed by the January 6th House Select Committee and not to Navarro. Notably, in a separate hearing in the courtroom adjacent to the one where Navarro was testifying, federal prosecutors in Trump's prosecution revealed the former president's legal team had mounted multiple sealed court battles over assertions of executive privilege in an unsuccessful attempt to stop a number of grand jury witnesses from testifying in the special counsel's probe. Before Monday's hearing, Judge Mehta ruled that Navarro would need to show formal, concrete proof during Monday's hearing that such protections had been invoked to make the privilege or immunity defense at trial. Judge Mehta also specified that any argument about testimonial immunity would only apply to the second count for which Peter Navarro was charged, related to his refusal to testify, and the first count, related to the production of relevant records, would be subject only to executive privilege. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. Former Trump White House official Peter Navarro testified in federal court on Monday, 28th of August, that former President Donald Trump made it very clear executive privilege should be invoked over testimony he was subpoenaed to give the House January 6th committee investigating the Capitol attack last year. Peter Navarro was charged with contempt of Congress after refusing to cooperate with a congressional investigation into the 6th of January 2021 Capitol attack. The two counts stem from his failure to appear for a deposition before the House committee investigating the attack and for failing to produce documents requested by the committee. He has pleaded not guilty. "It was clear during that call that privilege was invoked, very clear," Peter Navarro said on Monday, 28th of August, describing a 20th of February 2022 phone call with Donald Trump, which came days after Navarro had been subpoenaed by the House panel, according to multiple reports. He later added there was no question that privilege had been invoked from the get-go. "No question at all," he said. Justice Department prosecutors have argued in multiple executive privilege battles that only the current president and not a former president holds the power to block officials from testifying. Judge Amit Mehta, who is overseeing Peter Navarro's case, called Navarro's defense arguments pretty weak sauce and noted that the court still did not know what Donald Trump had said to the former White House aide to leave him with the impression that executive privilege had been invoked, according to the reports. Former White House advisor Steve Bannon was also charged with and later convicted of two counts of contempt of Congress for evading the House January 6th committee. Steve Bannon was sentenced to 4 months in prison, though he has not yet served that time after a judge said he could remain free pending appeal. Peter Navarro served as an economic advisor to Donald Trump and promoted his false claims of election fraud after the 2020 presidential election. CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. The federal judge overseeing Peter Navarro's contempt of Congress criminal case on Monday, 28th of August, called his defense arguments pretty weak sauce, injecting last-minute uncertainty into how the former Donald Trump advisor will be able to defend himself during his upcoming trial. Navarro, Donald Trump's one-time trade advisor, testified on Monday in his defense during a key pre-trial hearing in his case. He's facing charges for defying subpoenas issued to him by the House Select Committee that investigated the U.S. Capitol attack on 6th of January 2021, claiming he did so because Donald Trump asserted executive privilege in the matter. But during the nearly three-hour hearing before U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta in Washington, D.C., the judge appeared highly skeptical of Peter Navarro's testimony, noting it's from one side of the conversation. "I still don't know what the president said," Judge Mehta told Navarro's attorney Stanley Woodward, referring to a 20th of February 2022 phone call during which Peter Navarro said it was made clear the former president was invoking executive privilege. "I don't have any words from the former president," Judge Mehta said. "That's pretty weak sauce," the judge added, referring this time to a comment that Navarro says Trump made to him about regretting not letting him testify. The comment had been used by Peter Navarro and his legal team to bolster their argument that Donald Trump did invoke privilege because his subsequent regret indicated as much.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to polish our hearts when it comes to a Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear friends, it's an honor to be here at your service. We are talking about a Islamic lifestyle, and we are talking about what polishes our hearts. Now, of course, if we want to live a Islamic lifestyle, one of the things that is really important in the Islamic lifestyle is the heart. Now, the heart can be called this metaphysical center of a human being. Now, in different places, it's known with different names. Sometimes it is called the heart. Sometimes it is called the soul or the self. There's various names to it, but it is this center of a human being, and it's very important. So in one of the traditions, we find that, for example, it is said that the Almighty Allah will accept from a believer a pure heart, a qalb salim, a healthy heart, a heart which does not have polytheism within it, which does not ascribe partners to the Almighty Allah, right? And so passions and also love and the various different virtues, as well as the negative aspects, are usually they involve the heart. So it is of incredible importance for us to have a healthy heart, to have a polished heart. Now, how do we polish this heart of ours? What's interesting is one of the things which has been related when it comes to this Islamic lifestyle and in order to have this pure and healthy heart is this idea that one should constantly be in remembrance of death. Now, I know this seems a little bit morbid to talk about death, but in reality, the remembrance of death is something which polishes the heart, and we will continue our discussion in the next segment. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about having a polished heart, a pure heart, a healthy heart, metaphysically speaking, when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, if you want to live an Islamic lifestyle, you're going to have a pure heart, a healthy heart, a heart which is free from the stains of corruption and sin and misguidance, and at the same time, a heart that is filled with the light of the knowledge of the Almighty Allah, and a heart which is filled with the light of worship and obedience to the Almighty Allah. Now, already we've kind of talked about a couple of different things that we can do in order to polish our heart, right? Because if you want to live a Islamic lifestyle, you know, your heart is going to have to be in it. So, for example, if your heart is not attuned to, or if your heart is not really, you know, in par and in sync with your Islamic lifestyle, then it's not going to work, right? I mean, whatever you want to do, your heart has to be involved. Now, in order to polish the heart, of course, we talked about how we need to refrain from sinning and how we need to be obedient to the Almighty Allah. But the thing that we brought up in the previous segment was the idea of death. When one continuously remembers death and knows that the ultimate abode is the eternal abode, then this really starts to cleanse our heart and purify our heart so that we are better able to live a Islamic lifestyle and we are more happy living our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Emergency and relief crews in Hawaii have all but finished searching for victims of the deadliest U.S. wildfire in more than a century, authorities confirmed on Tuesday, 29th of August. But it is still unclear how many people died in the disaster. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered the story and tells us more. Crews in Hawaii have all but finished searching for victims of the deadliest U.S. wildfire in more than a century, authorities confirmed on Tuesday, 29th of August, and it is still unclear how many people died in the disaster. 3 weeks after the fire devastated Maui's historic seaside community of Lahaina, the count of the dead stands at 115. But an unknown number of people are still missing. Maui County officials on 24th of August released the names of 388 people who were unaccounted for, part of a larger group of roughly 1,000 to 1,100 people that had been estimated missing by the FBI. However, within a day of its release, more than 100 of those on the list or their relatives came forward to say that they were safe. The FBI confirmed the following day. Officials told CBS News that it doesn't necessarily mean those 100-plus people have been removed from the list, because that new information still needed to be vetted and confirmed. Officials suggested that responders likely have already recovered any remains that are recognizable as such, and they are shifting the response to focus on removing hazardous waste and making the area safe for residents to begin returning to their homes. We have wrapped up almost completely the search and recovery mission and moving into the next phase, Daryl Oliveira, the interim administrator of the Maui Emergency Management Agency, said at a news conference on Tuesday, 29th of August. The next phase would be hazardous waste removal conducted by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, he said. Wildfire smoke is known to cause a range of health issues, most notably breathing difficulties. But when they burn through cities, the flames also burn up industrial items, buildings, cars, and a slew of other things that can release toxic chemicals into the air. According to the state's Department of Health, toxic contaminants present in the debris and ash remain a top hazardous concern in Lahaina, as do other heavy metals and chemicals that may be in the form of ash remains of the city, such as asbestos. Maui Police Chief John Pelletier said urban search and rescue teams have completed 100% of their area, but some search activity continues in the ocean off Lahaina. The FBI is searching 200 yards out along a 4-mile stretch of coastline, but no human remains have been found, he said. There are 110 missing persons reports filed with Maui Police, and more than 50 of those remain open cases that are still actively being worked upon, he said. Although the initial land search is complete, authorities may also use details from the missing person reports to go over areas again. They say, "My loved one was here, and this may be a data point, and we can continue," Pelletier said. "In case there was a chance that something needs to be further looked at, we've got archaeologists and we're going to make sure that we can do that again. We can do this the right way." He asked for trust and patience as officials continue to identify remains and go through lists of missing persons. So far, authorities have identified and notified the loved ones of 45 of those killed. They have collected DNA samples from 120 people to identify the dead and continue to see more samples. Q Canada's national broadcaster, the CBC, has also covered the same story and tells us more. 3 weeks after the deadliest U.S. wildfire in more than a century swept through the Maui community of Lahaina, authorities say more than 800 people remain unaccounted for. It's a staggering number that presents huge challenges for officials trying to determine how many of those people were killed and how many may have made it to safety but haven't checked in. Something similar happened in 2018 after a wildfire killed 85 people and destroyed the town of Paradise in California. Authorities there ultimately published a list of the missing persons in the local newspaper, a decision that helped identify scores of people who had made it out alive but were listed as missing. Within a month, the list dropped from 1,300 names to only a dozen. Maui authorities have opted not to publicize their list because it's unclear whether privacy rules would prevent them from doing so, according to Adam Weintraub, a spokesperson for the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency. There are also concerns about further traumatizing families of those who are now listed as missing but may turn out to be dead. The names of and any information related to the missing individuals will not be published or be made publicly available at this time, a Maui County spokesperson said via text messaging. As of Monday, there were 115 people confirmed dead, according to Maui police. The FBI's Honolulu office is assisting Maui officials in locating the missing persons, in part by collecting DNA samples from relatives, the agency said in a statement. The American Red Cross said it generates its own list, separate from law enforcement, of people who are unaccounted for, through requests made to its call center and information gathered by its field teams, a spokesperson Daniel Parra confirmed. The American Red Cross organization has also entered into a data-sharing agreement with federal, state, and local government agencies to help with reunifications. So far, the American Red Cross has successfully completed roughly 2,400 requests seeking reunification or welfare updates out of more than 3,000 it has received. A completed request means the organization was able to locate a missing person or verify someone's status in a medical facility, for example, among other things. Fire experts, however, are saying it is possible there may be no remains left to identify some people through DNA tests.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are our true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to another session of The Last Savior. In this program, we discuss about Imam Zaman, alayhi salam, and we try to get the most updated information about Imam of our time from our experts. And today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Dr. Karibi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, according to Ethnologue, a database of world languages, there are currently approximately 7,117 known languages in the world. Well, as this number keeps on changing as the languages get discovered, and this is beyond the particular dialects. Well, why I'm saying that is because Dr. Karimi told us in the previous episode that there will be this heavenly cry which would be heard by everyone on the earth. Just imagine 7,000 plus languages and so many dialects with just one country Jana speaking 840 different languages, and that's not less than a miracle. And Dr. Karimi has been helping us to understand this about the heavenly cry. Who will be hearing this?
Yes, as you rightly mentioned, there are some authentic narrations referring to the fact that one of the, it's right to say that miraculous features of this heavenly cry that every person, every group of people will hear this heavenly cry in their own language. So if you are speaking Arabic with a specific dialect, you will hear that heavenly cry in your own language.
Okay.
And this is very clearly mentioned in the narrations. For example, يَسْمَعَهُ كُلَّ قَوْمٍ بِأَلْسَنَتِهِمْ. Every nation will hear this heavenly cry with their own language.
Right.
Al-Ghiba Bashir Tusi, page 431. Zorar says that, I asked Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, أَنَّدَاءُ حَقْ. Is the heavenly cry a truth? Meaning that, is it one of the signs for the reappearance of the Imam? Imam said, Iwallah, yes, of course, I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that it is the truth. All people, all nations will hear the voice, the heavenly cry, with their own language. And the last narration is, Hammun yasma'u kulla qawmin bilisanahim. This is in Kamaluddin, volume 2, page 556. So there is no doubt, based on these authentic narrations, that this heavenly cry has different miraculous points. One of them is that it can be heard in many, many different languages. And the second miraculous point is that this sound has a kind of uniformity, meaning that when it comes to the tone is the same for all the people. I'm talking about the tone and the volume, maybe.
Right.
So it's not that, for the people of Mecca, as if they are hearing the voice from a close distance, and for the people in Africa, it is heard as if it is coming from a far place. No. There is a kind of sound uniformity. All the people hear the voice in a similar way.
Okay.
And again, it can be a miraculous aspect of this heavenly cry.
Right.
In an authentic narration, Imam Rida alayhi salam is quoted as saying, قَدْ نُودُوا نِدَاءً. The people hear a cry. It is heard from the far places, like the people who hear it from a close distance. It means that there is no difference which place of the earth you are living, you are staying. All the people hear the heavenly cry in completely similar way. It doesn't make any difference where you are living. This is in Kamaluddin, volume 2, page 59. The last point that I would like to share about the audience of the heavenly cry is that some narrations refers to one specific group of people.
Right.
And they are called Al-Fatatu min Khadraha. The girls from, literally translating, from behind the curtains.
Right.
They also hear the voice. So why, maybe some people ask, why this specific group is mentioned in the narrations? Because at least in the past, and maybe for many centuries, it was a custom, a culture for the people, especially among the Arab people, for the girls to stay at home and to not only stay at home, to be behind the curtains.
Right. No, and that was also the culture in India. We'll talk more about that exactly after a short break. Hey, listeners, stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. Dr. Karimi is helping us to get a deep dive into the heavenly cry, which is a sign of reappearance of Imam Mahdi.
Even in the past, and maybe nowadays in some places, the houses were divided into two parts. In the inside part of the house, maybe the girls would stay there so that they couldn't, the strangers couldn't see them. And so the girls in that part of the house couldn't hear also anything from outside.
Right.
So that is the point why some narrations are referring to this group. Just putting emphasis on the fact that all the people would hear the voice, even those people, those girls,
no matter what,
inside the house,
right,
and behind the curtains. For example, yes, the Imam says, يَسْمَعُ أَهْلُ الْمَشْرِقِ وَالْمَغْرِبِ. The people of the east and west will hear the call. Even the girls from behind the curtains will hear it. Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 265. And another interesting narration reads, the girl behind the curtains, she hears the voice. Interesting, the girls, according to this narration, she asks and encourages her father and brother to go to help Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. This is Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 262, hadith number 13. So this is the reason that some narrations refer to this specific group of people, just to put emphasis on the fact that no one is excluded. All the people will hear the heavenly cry.
Right. Now, Dr. Karimi, we have talked a lot about hearing this cry. Now, what is the reaction of people who are hearing this cry?
What is understood from the narrations is that, first of all, this heavenly cry is sudden, so no one is waiting for it. And that is why, and of course, it is in a miraculous way. Imagine all the people of the world, all of them at the same time, they hear a voice, a call from the heaven, which is understood in different languages. And of course, after waiting for the Imam for centuries, now the heavenly cry is announcing the coming of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Right.
So for sure, it would be causing some people to get very much surprised. And
right,
also, it would cause fear for some people. And it is a very normal reaction of the people when they, I mean, imagine after so many centuries of waiting and going through all difficulties, now you hear a heavenly cry with all those miraculous features that I mentioned.
Right.
We can say that fear accompanied with, surprise
joy
and astonishment can be a very logical reaction of at least many people.
All right. Dr. Karimi, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome again. And we are discussing some of the features of the heavenly cry. Dr. Karimi is helping us. And Dr. Karimi, you said the reaction of the people is mixed one. Some are surprised. I want to know about, like, there may be tyrants as well hearing the cry, because we talked about, like, there will be all creatures on the earth. Everyone who has a soul will be hearing this cry. But there's definitely somewhere waiting for Imam, like you added to our knowledge that this cry is one of the signs of reappearance. So those who had been waiting for Imam, it will be a source of joy for them. And those who are tyrants, it will be definitely not much happy. They will be surprised, or there will be different reactions. So you were talking about different reactions of people,
exactly,
on hearing this cry.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for distinguishing the people into those people who are waiting for the Imam and the tyrant people. Now, it is very interesting to know that, according to some authentic narrations, the first reaction of all the people is that all of them would believe in Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
And
okay, this is very interesting. But as I will explain later, it is only in the initial stage. Later, some people again disbelieve in Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. I'm talking about those tyrant people that you referred to.
Okay.
But At the first stage, all the people who hear the heavenly cry, they will believe in Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Which in itself is a miraculous.
Exactly. And they believe because of also the miraculous aspects of the heavenly cry as well.
Right.
The Imam says, فَيُؤْمِنُ أَهْلُ الْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا لِسَوْتِ الْأَوَّلِ. As soon as the people of the earth, they hear the first heavenly cry, because we talked about the possibility of having two calls, all the people of the earth would believe. Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 269, hadith number 20. In another narration, the Imam says, you cannot find any person on the earth on that day except that they would accept the call. They would believe. فَيُؤْمَنُ أَهْلُ الْأَرْضِ إِذَا سَمِعُوا صَوْتَ مَنَ السَّمَاءِ. The people of the earth, as soon as they hear the voice, the call from the heaven, they would believe.
Right.
Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 267, hadith number 19. The narrator says, this is another narration, فَقُلْتُ لَهُ, I asked the Imam, أَهِيَ السَّيْحَ, is it a call? The Imam says that when this heavenly cry would happen, enemies of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would be also humiliated before this call, meaning that this would also believe in the Imam. And one narration specifically refers to one group among the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and they are Bani Umayyah, the Umayyads.
Okay.
The Imam says, تَخْضَعُ رِقَابُهُمْ يَعْنِي بَنِي أُمَيَّةِ وَهِيَ سَيْحَةُ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ بِاسْمِ صَاحِبِ الْأَمْرِ. When people hear this heavenly cry, they would believe in the Imam, they would be humiliated before the Imam, including Banu Umayyah. So this is the first reaction of all the people. The fact that according to these group of narrations, some of which are authentic, all the people, including the tyrants, the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt, would believe in the call in Imam.
Right.
But as I will explain later, some of them, unfortunately, again, they would be deceived by the Satan.
Right. So thank you so much for adding to our knowledge again. And that was really helpful. And we'll discuss more with you in the upcoming episodes. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners for listening. In case you want to listen to our programs again, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. And you can go to the tab COI, Call of Islam, and find an archive of our programs over there. You can also search us on the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio, and you'll find the clips of our programs over there. And in case you have any questions regarding our program or your feedback, or in case you have any queries regarding the Imam of our time, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Thank you so much. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow? Please, oh please, please come.
In the limelight.
Imprisoned migrant children who arrive in Britain by small boats are said to experience significant harm and endure psychological trauma by being locked in cells in the presence of sex offenders. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Vulnerable children who arrive in Britain by small boat are being placed in an adult prison that holds significant numbers of sex offenders. A growing number of cases have been identified where unaccompanied children, many of whom appear to be trafficked, have been sent to His Majesty's prison at Elmley in Kent and placed among foreign adult prisoners. According to the most recent inspection of Elmley, the block where foreign nationals are held also houses sex offenders. Of 14 unaccompanied children so far identified by staff at Humans for Rights Network as being sent to an adult prison, one is believed to have been 14 years old when they spent 7 months in Elmley. Most of the cases involve Sudanese or South Sudanese children who travelled to the United Kingdom via Libya, with most appearing to have been trafficked or having experienced some form of exploitation. Recently, there were calls for the Home Office to launch an immediate investigation into the issue and urgently release anyone believed to be a child who is inside an adult jail. Maddie Harris of Human Rights Network said the group had worked with more than 1,000 age-disputed children and that those sent to adult prisons were among the most profoundly harmed. She said these children are locked down in their cells not knowing who to call for help, prevented from adequately accessing legal advice and from challenging the arbitrary decision made about their ages by immigration officials upon arrival in the United Kingdom. These are children looking for safety who instead find themselves in an adult prison, denied that protection and exposed to great harm. Anita Horrell, head of the Migrant Children's Project at the children's charity Coram, said, "It's wrong to criminalise these children and dangerous to send them to adult men's prisons. The children, whose ages are contested by the Home Office, have been charged with immigration offences introduced under the Nationality and Borders Act, which became law last year and introduces tougher criminal offences to deter illegal entry to Britain. Lawyers warn that the practice of sending unaccompanied children to adult prisons appears to be increasing. On Thursday, 24th of August, an age-disputed child was identified in Folkestone Magistrates Court, bound for prison, and there were reports of another minor was in police custody in Margate in Kent and also expected to be sent to Elmsley Prison. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. Critics say the imprisoning of minors is the latest facet of a broken asylum system in Britain. On Thursday, 24th of August, the asylum backlog rose to a high of more than 175,000, up 44% from last year, despite government spending on asylum almost doubling. The migrant children sent to Elmley Prison in Kent were declared adults by the Home Office following what many experts describe as a cursory and arbitrary age assessment by officials, often conducted within hours of them reaching the United Kingdom by small boat. A number of Home Office decisions that meant children were sent to an adult prison have already been overturned after detailed assessments by independent or local authority specialists. New data obtained by The Independent confirms that hundreds of asylum seeker children are being wrongly treated as adults by the Home Office. According to data from dozens of councils, more than half of the unaccompanied asylum seeking children who undergo Home Office age assessments on arrival into the United Kingdom are later confirmed to be children. Data from 55 local councils under Freedom of Information laws shows that 1,416 age assessments carried out over the last 5 years to April by specialist social workers on age-disputed asylum seekers, 809 were found to be children. In 10 councils, all of the young people assessed were found to be children. Sid Bolton, co-director of Equal Justice for Migrant Children, said, "Age assessment has developed into the most monstrous of procedural devices." Sid Bolton said he considered the practice to be a deliberate barrier to assessing asylum protection and denying young asylum seekers access to children's services. It is a major tool of the Home Office in discrediting an asylum claim. Wrongly classifying children as adults means they can be placed alone in unsupervised accommodation alongside adults. Maddie Harris of Human Rights Network said, in Elmley Prison, youngsters shared cells, although a number of age-disputed children had since been released. According to Elmsley's latest inspection, one in four inmates in a survey said they felt unsafe in the jail. It also said that despite the prison being no longer designed to hold prisoners convicted of a sexual offence, 70 such inmates were still there. Days ago, details emerged of a prisoner being held at Elmley Prison who was convicted of 14 sex offences and found guilty of abusing two children. Harris added, the children are always deeply harmed by the time they have spent in prison in Britain, expressing clearly how they are unable to sleep, do not understand why they were held there, and struggle to speak about their time there. She added, it should be made clear that neither adult or children should be criminalised for arriving in the United Kingdom to claim asylum, an offence that clearly contravenes the Refugee Convention. Anita Horrell, head of the Migrant Children's Project at the children's charity Coram, referred to a recent court ruling that unaccompanied minors should be looked after by councils where they can be kept safe and recover. It is thought that many more unaccompanied children have been placed in adult prisons. Human Rights Network staff attending hearings at Folkestone Magistrates Court have identified them by noticing a young person contesting the date of birth given to them by immigration officials upon arrival in the United Kingdom. A government spokesperson said, assessing the age is a challenging but vital process to identify genuine children and stop abuse of the system. We must prevent adults claiming to be children or children being wrongly treated as adults. Both present serious safeguarding risks. The spokesperson claimed, to further protect children, we are strengthening the age verification process by using scientific measures such as X-rays. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's plan to reduce small boat crossings will effectively reverse a ban on child detention implemented under David Cameron and open the door to an expansion of the practice. With a potential Tory rebellion already brewing over the proposals, it has emerged that the illegal migration bill will allow the detention of families with children and even allows the deportation of unaccompanied children if it's deemed to be safe in their country of origin. Several senior Conservatives are particularly worried about changes to the way children will be treated when arriving in the United Kingdom, and the way in which the new bills come close to breaching international laws. One former minister said, the changes to rules on children make me sick just to mention, and would have to be modified.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Reasons behind enemies targeting Islam is the political rules of Islam. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps on August 17, 2023. In the Imam Khomeini's Hosseiniyeh. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, all praise is due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessing be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure chosen progeny, particularly the remnant of God on earth. May our soul be sacrificed for his sake. Wishing all of you a warm welcome here. It is a very pleasing and enjoyable day for me to meet with you, dear ones. You, the men of the revolution and the guardians of the truth and truthfulness, I thank the Honorable Commander of IRGC and the Honorable Representative for their statements. Their statements were very good. I would like to use a part of my speech today to briefly speak about the IRGC. I would like to share some of the things about IRGC that may have been mentioned many times before. But at the same time, our people, our youth, and the IRGC's own youth need to hear these things again. We must not forget our identity.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One of the goals of the world's Satans is to make us forget who we are. We should not allow that to happen. I would like to briefly talk about the IRGC and also mention a few words about the revolution that the IRGC shoulders, the duty of the gardening it. What are the characteristics of this revolution that you are gardening? I will also mention a few words in this regard. I've written down a few points about the IRGC to share with you. The first point is that the formation of the IRGC at the beginning of the revolution was a unique phenomenon compared to the other great revolutions that have taken place throughout history. In major revolutions such as the French Revolution or the Soviet Bolshevik Revolution, there were groups that emerged in the beginning of those revolutions as supporters of that revolution, and they took certain actions. Yet the IRGC is clearly not comparable to those groups and to those people. Those groups and people were destructive, acted on their own, were undisciplined, and did not adhere to principles. That's not how the IRGC was, and from the time it was formed, and this is important, the IRGC was established under the supervision of the Corps of Revolution.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
You've done. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Almost 3 years after he was given the all-clear by pharmacy regulator, the General Pharmaceutical Council, pro-Palestine activist Nazim Ali's fitness to pursue his career as a pharmacist is being questioned again by the same regulator.
A tribunal at the regulator's headquarters here in Canary Wharf, East London, has been tasked with establishing whether or not Mr. Ali's words, such as Zionists are not Jews, which he spoke at a 2017 Al-Quds rally in the British capital, were, quote, objectively anti-Semitic.
The hearing was pushed for by what's collectively known as the Zionist lobby in the UK, pro-Israeli organizations with a penchant for going after pro-Palestine activists.
It's a deliberate sort of attempt at conflating and making the water muddy, as it were, that distinction between anti-Semitism and sort of anti-Zionism or anti-Israel speech. And they're deliberately sort of muddying the water. They're using the IHRA definition, and they're sort of throwing as much as they can to confuse things. And it's a way of sort of silencing speech.
Nazim Ali, a pharmacist of some 30 years, is but one example of how the Zionist lobby weaponizes anti-Semitism to silence critics of Israel. Other recent examples are former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, former Labour MP Chris Williamson, the rapper Lowkey, and Bristol University professor David Miller. Also present at the hearing, Mr. Ali's family, who have experienced his ordeal with him every step of the way for the past 6 years.
Well, it most certainly hasn't been easy when you see your father plastered over different news outlets online and in print media with headlines and photos that aren't the most flattering, that represent him in a very negative light. I can't go on the record and say that people are lying, per se, but certainly there are many falsities that are out there that have been published against him that cause a lot of frustration. And one day we hope that justice will be served, not only in the courts, but also in the public eye as well.
Just a song? No, you mentioned the word bomb.
Also known for his sharp wit and his stand-up comedy that challenges Muslim stereotypes and anti-Muslim tropes, Mr. Ali took to social media before the hearing, asking his supporters to pray for him to succeed in putting the case against him to rest once and for all. Saeed Pourreza, London.
A global campaign has been launched by humanitarian activists calling for a lifting of the blockade on Sana'a International Airport. The airport was forcibly closed by the Saudi-led coalition shortly after its invasion on Yemen in 2015. The signing of a ceasefire agreement deal with the Saudi-led coalition last year was supposed to alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni patients. But in effect, nothing has changed for those in need of medical treatment.
According to reports, nearly 8,000 sick Yemenis have passed away during the ceasefire because they were not able to fly out of the country in time to get proper medical treatment. Medical health officials are calling the closure of Sana'a Airport a grave public health tragedy.
And that's because more sick Yemenis will continue to die if they are unable to fly out for life-saving medical treatment.
We launched this campaign with both Yemeni and non-Yemeni activists to make it clear that Sana'a Airport remains besieged. Only three flights consisting of 700 passengers are allowed a week. Before the aggression, that number was 6,000 passengers a week. There are many sick patients who need to fly out of the country for immediate medical treatment. Currently, there are 30,000 sick patients unable to fly out of the country because of this blockade.
The campaign to open Sana'a Airport has attracted much support from human rights and anti-war activists worldwide, demanding an end to the blockade.
From Canada, we join our voice to people in Yemen and all over the world that are condemning and denouncing the continued